don't know the answer to that, but it seems to me that that individual...
He's sent to another village.
Carry on.
It seems to me that that individual has lost his tribal membership. And that's not how, by and large, United States citizens are treated under their constitution. The other thing that we need to identify that I haven't heard anything about is how do Alaska Natives handle the presumable role of dual membership? Dual membership, one, as a citizen of the United States and the state of Alaska, two, as a tribal member. And how does that dual membership intertwine in everyday functions of either a tribal government or a state government or an entity under the federal government's auspices? There's obviously a lot of criticisms about a tribal entity because it's considered to be a closed system, where the system in the state of, under the state of Alaska or federal government is deemed to be open to all citizens equally. Those are questions that are not answered clearly. I've heard some varying answers from a number of individuals as to how that should be dealt with, but by and large, I haven't heard any response to that criticism that I'm comfortable with. And I haven't heard a real comfortable response from someone who is absolutely convinced that his or her system is how it should work. But again, I'm willing to say, well, let's grow with it and see what happens to it. I'm starting to ramble.
Well, Tony, thanks for those thoughtful remarks. Maybe I could make a few observations of my own in light of what Sheldon and Tony have said. This commission is unique in that it isn't sponsored, and everywhere I've gone in the state, every village, every town, I have made it clear that I do not represent the government of the United States or the state of Alaska, that this is an undertaking sponsored by two international Native peoples organizations. And I may say that at the outset, I was skeptical of this whole undertaking, but I found as I proceeded around the state that I was well received and people accepted, I think, that this was a worthwhile venture. And I think they understood the limitations. They knew I wasn't there as the designate of the state or the federal government. And I think that we're charting some new territory, and I don't think anybody can foresee the impact that this commission's recommendations will have. They may have no impact, they may have very little impact, they may have considerable impact. I may say that I'll look forward with great interest to see what the outcome may be. We've tried all along to work closely with all of the Native organizations in Alaska, and indeed we have invited to these roundtables. In fact, we've had a standing invitation to both the AFN and the UTA, and I should say that the AFN has usually sent somebody who's participated. Charlie Johnson, the president of AFN, has been to two roundtables, participated fully in them, and I should also say that I think in every region I've been to, officers of the regional corporation have testified at the hearings. I think there are maybe one or two exceptions. We've sought in every village we've been to have the corporation, or the local village corporation, and the tribal government, and we've had it, I think, in every case. Where the village corporation is functioning, where the tribal government is functioning, some places both are not functioning, some places neither. And then we've turned to the city government. It's quite a varied picture. The But some people have asked in the villages what you've asked, and it may be appropriate if I just say what I've said to them. They've said, well, why are we here? Very few have said it, but occasionally they've said it. Why are you here? And I've said, well, I was asked to come. And it may not have been an invitation that was unanimously offered, but it seemed to me appropriate to accept. But I said, my job is to go around the state and hear what people in the villages and the towns have to say. How did this land claim settlement work out? And I've said to them, I'm here to find out how you feel about it. How did it work out here in the village, on the ground? And what are the problems as you see them, and where do we go from here? And I've said, my report will reflect what those people in the villages told me, and insofar as it lies within the my capacity, or in anyone's, I suppose, I will try to frame recommendations that meet the concerns that they have. And I have said that the report will be released in September, and I'll send it to every village corporation and every tribal government and all the other organizations in the state. And I've said as well that I'll send it to everybody who testified, and then it's up to them. That's my job. And then it is for Alaska Natives, in one fashion or another, to decide what they make of it and how useful it may be to them in planning for the future. I think that the issues that Alaska Natives are facing here are very, very tough. I don't think anybody who's examined them is under any illusions about that. And I hope that my report and recommendations will make a constructive contribution to resolving what is unprecedented in any jurisdiction, and which I think everyone believes has to be addressed. That's my job, and I guess it's appropriate that I should have, at this very last meeting, said something about what I conceive my my role to be. And it is, so far as I know, not the type of commission that has ever been undertaken before, and may never be again. not by me, at any rate, but it is conceivable that the precedent may have value one way or the other. It may be something that folks will decide in future they don't ever want to see again, and on the other hand, it is conceivable that folks may say, well, let's try that. But all of that lies in the future, I'll maintain my subscription after I leave Alaska to Tundra Times and Alaska Native News, and not to mention the Daily News and the Times, and we shall all await the outcome. But foretelling the future is a difficult thing to do. Steve, and then Mary.
Yeah, I am. Missed the one plane already today, so I'm going to go to the airport a little early. So I just want to say goodbye to everybody here. Thank you again for inviting us to the roundtable discussion. One of the things I forgot to mention this morning is that in the Northwest Territories, again, we have an agreement to begin a process to rename all the landmarks in the in our traditional area. So we have all the Scottish, English names. Some of them will be changed to Dene names. We hope to carry it on into to public buildings as well, in that it's all part of the process of decolonizing, I guess, and redefining the world. And as you know, Mr. Berger conducted an inquiry into an Arctic gas pipeline, or a couple of proposed pipelines in the Mackenzie Valley a number of years ago. So I guess this is a joke. We might suggest calling one of the lakes over there Berger Lake.
That's not that funny.
Anyway, thank you very much, and wish you all a safe trip home if you're traveling.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Thank you for coming. Mary Miller.
First of all, thank you for inviting me to sit in today, Judge Berger. I'd like to react and try to encourage some dialogue on what I listened to this morning. It's extremely frustrating to try to think like a white person. I got a very bad headache this morning from trying to follow the comments that were made, and finally rested back a little bit and didn't try after all. Anyhow, I want to respond on some points to Mr. Hsu's very noble effort to conceptualize the native status and aspirations into the dominant Western way of thinking. May I say, with all due respect, that that is not possible. You can try to make some approximations, but ultimately those approximations themselves will still be lacking. The reason that our relationship with the environment, the reason is that our relationship with the environment comes from our hearts. Our entire frame of reference is different. It is difficult even for us to verbalize our relationship to the land and resources. It's not an everyday topic of conversation. Therefore, an effort to compartmentalize, package, categorize indigenous groups to your understanding is at best inadequate. I would like to offer a bit of advice that may have some settling effect on all of this. And I think in really simple terms, but maybe what I'm saying isn't simple after all. It seems to me that to respect the fact that there is a difference in understanding is quite simple. It is in my mind anyway. So that even while Western, for example, while Western economic thought is embedded, entrenched in the doctrine of the alienability of land, in your own backyard there is an exception, because the doctrine of inalienability of land is even deeper entrenched in the much older tribal institutions than is your doctrine of alienability of land in Western thought. I got that out. That's the main thing that's been bothering me. Therefore, even as our allies and advocates of native rights, you too need to stretch your mind to the point of realizing that there are some differences in philosophy and thinking that you will have difficulty understanding, because most of it emanates from the heart and in fact cannot be translated into Western concepts. Just respect that and form your support on that basis, and try to communicate this respect to the rest of society that you deal with and that we will always have to be dealing with. Where do we go from here, and using what instruments? With respect to Alaska Natives and our place in the Western world, we cannot ignore our political identity that separates us from ethnic minorities in this country. Notice I did not say other ethnic minorities, because we are not ethnic minorities. And in fact, we must articulate very clearly to ourselves and to everyone else that we are not ethnic minorities. We do have a political identity, and we must keep this in mind as we decide what our place is in the Western world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Robert Goldwyn and then Orrin Young.
Well, when I thought you might call on me 20 minutes ago, I was prepared to say that you should skip me for a while because I didn't want to change the subject of many important things that I think were being said. But now the timing is perfect because I think what I have to say is an exact counterpart to what has just been said. And so I'll read what I've been scribbling out over the last few hours. First of all, I make a modest suggestion that the title of the conference might be The Place of Native Peoples in the World, rather than in the Western world. Because from what I'm about to say and what I think Orrin Young said in anticipation, anticipating well what I had been writing, the world is becoming something that might not be called Western anymore, and that anybody's place in the world has to be looked at in possibly a new way. We started the conference with the with a text. All mankind is one was the principle first enunciated by Lewis Hankey. And I think it's clear that all decent men and women of every culture subscribe to that principle. What it means is that we're all equal, not only in our rights, but in dignity, and that we're all made in the image of God. We know that there are many inequalities among mankind. We differ in individuals differ in strength and intelligence and industriousness, but that does not alter the equality of all human beings as equally human. We are truly brothers and sisters of one human family. But when we reflect further, it's also true to say that all mankind is divided into thousands and thousands of smaller groupings based on differences of language, religion, race, history, and way of life. The bonds that unite these smaller, different groupings are very strong. These bonds seem to give meaning and shape to our lives and our understanding of ourselves, who we are. And in fact, these bonds are much stronger in most cases than the bonds that unite all mankind and make us say that all mankind is one. It is just as true to say that all mankind is many. Now, this duality is evident everywhere. For instance, in the Declaration of Independence, whose central affirmation is a universal principle that all men are created equal. But it starts out by saying that this is a time when it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands that have connected them with another. In other words, although it is stating a universal principle about all men being equal, it states it on behalf of one people separating themselves from another people. Now, in recent decades, the hope has been encouraged that mankind would become more unified, that religious and racial differences would be reduced, that the boundaries that separate men would be diminished in importance, and that we would make political progress toward becoming one world. At the same time, the economy has become increasingly a world economy. And these are things that Orrin Young pointed out so well before lunch. And this world economy has been growing in size and importance and growing in independence from political control, leaping over national boundaries and tending to standardize and even homogenize the merchandise of world markets. You can travel all around the world now and you see the same goods in identical stores, no matter what city you're in, on whatever continent. In addition, of course, we have high technology, which through computers and communications and transportation, again, are overleaping the national boundaries and to a large extent reducing, if not eliminating, their significance. Now, these globalizing tendencies have produced a strong and startling counter-reaction. The incredible material benefits of commerce and technology are not distributed very evenly, and neither are the disadvantages. A significant number suffer disadvantages that far outweigh the benefits. Now, chief among these disadvantages is a certain emptiness characterized by shallow television programs and alcoholism and drug use, which is worldwide. This that we all associate with modernity, and that now, in this conference, we can associate with the dual truths that all mankind is one and that all mankind is many. The movement is strong all over the world, away from the larger entities and back to these smaller groupings based on religion, language, and way of life. It seems to me to be a powerful factor of human nature that individuals have a strong need to be part of a community, and that the world community or national community or anything like it does not satisfy the need for most people. The need to be closely associated with people of the same kind, however that's defined. In fact, the meaningful communities seem to be grouped now on different bases and to have the characteristic of being exclusive. The story that was told about the two Sikh men on the train, I think well illustrates the two sides, the duality that I'm talking about. Here were bonds of community so strong, so vital, so essential to that man's life, so precious to him that he would not cut his hair, even though he knew the danger that he faced. But that story also tells us that because of hatred between Sikhs and other groups, they are moved even to murder each other. And in this case, we have to emphasize the fact that the killers were Hindus, that is, the people of nonviolence. Now that's, I think, the problem that we have to face as we talk about the importance of community, that community has the effect also of dividing people into very hostile groups, as well as providing that meaning to life that we all derive from community of people with people of a like way of life. Now, Shelton gave an analogy yesterday of the relations of different kinds of peoples to marriage, and he said there were standards of elements of a good marriage, and which he called the four C's: commitment, consideration, communication, and cooperation. Now, I checked with Shelton, and he isn't married. I've been married for 40 years, and I thought I saw a certain defect in what he was saying, but I didn't want to rely on my experience alone. So before he left this morning, I checked with Lewis Hanke, who's been married for 59 years, and he agreed with me. Of course, what Shelton left out was love. You can't have a good marriage without love, even if you pledge yourself and practice as hard as you can commitment, consideration, communication, and cooperation. You can be friends, you can be partners, you can be associates, but you can't be married. So it seems to me it's not a good analogy. The trouble is that hatred is more common between strongly loyal communities than love. And it's not just difficulties of Aboriginal people in their relations with each other or with other societies. It's a universal human condition. What joins us to others separates us from others. Now, we live in a time, I think it's fair to say, of worldwide disarray. There's been a severe weakening of the national political powers. It's a time of disconcertingly rapid change. And peoples of every kind are struggling for survival as a separate and distinct people all over the world, not just the Aboriginal peoples. Orrin Young said in describing the same phenomenon that it's a good era. And what he means is that there are opportunities for significant beneficial change. But of course, it remains to be seen how good it will be. We don't know if the changes will be changes for the better. But many peoples, including Native peoples, but not only Native peoples, very many, numbering in the hundreds of millions, do not have control as a people over their own lives. One can make a long list of them. I tried to pick ones that one wouldn't think of ordinarily. The Germans are not unified and longing for unification. The Basques in Spain, the Tamils in Sri Lanka, the Welsh in the United Kingdom, the Formosans on Taipei, and one could extend that list indefinitely. They all think of themselves as separate and distinct peoples. They differ markedly in their way of life, their language, their religion, race, from those in whose midst they live, and they can honestly say they do not have control over their lives as a separate and distinct people. Now, we have spoken of the dominant culture over and over again. Of course, I'm in a strange situation here. Anywhere else, it's ironic that I should end up as the spokesman of the dominant culture because, as I think the only Jew in the house, I am of a tiny minority element, but a separate and distinct people who have long experience in living in the midst of aliens in our own land, and champion survivors, although don't always do too well. But at any rate, it falls to me to say some things about dominant culture. Now, the dominant culture is as hard to understand as the Aboriginal culture. And I think it's wrong to say, don't make any claims to be able to describe it. How in the world can anyone say anything effective that will bring about constructive change if all you can say is, you know, those people have a special relationship to the land. I can't explain it to you. They can't explain it to you, but take it seriously. I don't think that's going to be very effective. But don't think that the dominant culture is an easy one to describe. It also is not just one, but many. In fact, a multiplicity of cultures with a very long history and a very complicated literature that goes back thousands of years and which involves a very great variety and controversies. It is a long, very difficult task to understand the Western culture. And I think we distort the problem very seriously and end up with a bad diagnosis to think that we can describe the dominant culture very easily, but it's the Aboriginal culture that's difficult to explain. The dominant culture is not one thing, and it is just as complicated as Aboriginal culture to explain and define. There are varieties of Western thought, and consistent with my suggestion that we have to think of world now rather than Western world, the dominant culture includes now many non-Western influences. Bishop DeRue spoke of recommending that we, for liberating purposes, that we look at the dominant culture from its underside. And all I could think of was getting to the movies too late when there's a very popular movie being shown and ending up on the leftmost seat in the first row. Now that's looking at a movie from the underside. And what do you get? You see the same movie that everybody else is seeing, but it's all distorted. The people look 10 foot tall and very ugly. And I think that's what happens if you look at the dominant culture from the underside, 10 feet tall and very ugly. It's much better to look at things straight on and see it without distortion, 6 feet and not distorted. Now, the question was raised repeatedly by Shelton, why are Christians not Christian in their behavior? As a non-Christian, I can't answer the question with any confidence, but I do know this. Modernity means questioning. One of the participants and told me last night, I won't say who it is, we were talking about how we grew up, and he told me how he questioned himself right out of the church he belonged to. He asked questions that they couldn't answer, and finally they excommunicated him. That's how it is with the Christian world and with any credo, and especially with a tradition. It's not congenial to persist in questioning, and that's why modernity now has put all religions and all traditions very much on shaky ground. They're not especially compatible, except for Jews. The word Israel literally means wrestling with God. And Jews are questioners by tradition and by training and, as someone was arguing, in their genes. I'm not sure about that. But it is so that even with the Orthodox Jews, too much questioning is not congenial. And I think that it gives a clue to that modern Christians don't seem Christian in their behavior in the context in which you were asking about it, Shelton. I had another criticism of Bishop DeRue's paper, and that is he gives too much credit for power to the techno-industrial influence on Christianity. He dated the bad things from about 400 years ago with the rise, the Enlightenment, and the rise of techno-industrial influence. But it seems to me examples of invasion, oppression, suppression, murder, colonization abound in the Old Testament, in ancient Greek history, in Roman history. And that was before both Christianity and the techno-industrial influence. And then under Christianity, but before the techno-industrial influence, we had the Crusades, we had the Inquisition. My point is that we ought to look elsewhere for the explanation of the past injustices and the present plight. If we're seeking a cure, the diagnosis has to be right. And if we put the finger of blame on the wrong thing and then try to correct that, we may expend a lot of energy and wind up still with the problem. The causes of injustice are deeply rooted in human nature and not a recent phenomenon. Well, I conclude. I think the roots of the problem that we are wrestling with are twofold. First, we must hang on to the principle that mankind is one, a respect for the equal humanity of all men of whatever culture or way of life. And we must hold on to mankind is many, a sustained effort to understand the other ways of life and to explain our own to others and not be daunted by the obstacles of the natural hostility and the natural misunderstanding that are inherent in the problem. If we're going to get rid of injustice, we have to engage in a constant search for the real sources of injustice.
Thanks very much, Robert. Orrin Young.
First, two very brief comments on what others have said. On the notion that it's a good era, what I meant to say by it's a good era, and I think that Robert would probably agree with it, it's good because it's an era of opportunity. Certainly, we don't know that it's an era in which we are experiencing and will experience fairly dramatic kinds of changes rather than just marginal, incremental kinds of changes. Surely, we don't know that those will be changes for the better, but unless one believes in a certain sort of determinism, and for that matter, an unfortunate or negative determinism, it's a period in which there are at least opportunities for energetic, thoughtful people to consider bringing about serious changes. And I think that's, to me, an optimistic statement. Next, Mary made a comment about the entrenchment of the notion of inalienability of with respect to land and indigenous cultures. And I think I and perhaps several others had earlier on this morning made a comment about the entrenchment of alienability with respect to goods such as land and Western, much of Western, particularly Western economic thinking. My sense is that both of these things are true, and that the operative term in this context is entrenchment. We are, in other words, dealing with deep-seated, very entrenched intellectual or cognitive phenomena. And I think that that reinforces the question or the concern raised several times, certainly several days ago by Rosita, in saying that are we really dealing here with a very fundamental clash of values or worldviews, so fundamental that it's not a matter of necessarily always conscious opposition or antagonism, but simply inability to intersect or communicate because of the entrenched quality of quite different perspectives on things. Well, so much for those general points. I guess my issue I wanted to raise at this point is to wonder whether we might come around in this final session for at least a few minutes to the whole question of education, which I think Tom has introduced a couple of times in making comments. And I also have noticed on our handout sheet, our marching orders that were distributed yesterday, a question to the effect of how can education be used as a means to better promote indigenous rights? And I think that's a very intriguing and an important question, particularly because, as we all, I'm sure, know, in many circumstances, in many periods of time, education really has been part of the problem rather than part of the solution. A focus on education of a certain type might very well be regarded as the central element of something you might call liberal colonialism. I mean, not just good old conservative reactionary colonialism of the power-oriented sense, but the liberal, self-congratulatory sort of colonialism in which education has various kinds of assimilative loss of language, confusion of values kinds of effects. So it seems to me that the thing that I'm really interested in is how can one turn education around to do exactly what the question on the sheet suggested. I don't really know the answers to that. One particular concrete instance that I have been somewhat impressed by that might be worth giving a little thought to is the example of the Katowice School Board, an organization which many of you probably are quite familiar with. It's an entity that grew out of the James Bay settlement, and it's a regional school board for northern Quebec, Nouveau Quebec, and it has initiated a very extensive and very active program to transform, to have a really major impact on education and the Inuit communities of northern Quebec, focusing on the revival and strengthening of language, but much more than that, the preparation of educational materials, textbooks and other sorts of educational materials which would be based on Inuit materials, so that when kids get their textbooks to learn about a whole variety of basic subjects, they do so with the images and concepts and examples of their own setting and circumstances, so that the sort of socialization process is redirected in a way that's much more appropriate. That has struck me as a very interesting project. It's one that has been carried out in very large measure by Inuit people themselves, with some cooperation with other people. I wonder whether anybody had any further comments about this. How can education be used as a means to better promote Indigenous rights, particularly in the Alaska context, and whether there's anything in the settlement that somehow serves as an obstacle to development, or whether anyone has other responses to this question, which strikes me as really very fundamental.
Rosita?
I have a number of different points, and I guess we're not going to get into our dialogue or communication, but I'd like to respond to Oren's last statement before I outline at least my general perception of what I see happening. I've been struggling myself with, how are Native people going to achieve the cultural maintenance and autonomy that I think I hear them expressing as a desire and objective. And I guess I've been really excited about this kind of a discussion, and right now I'm again at a state of hopelessness again. And because the problems are so many, so immense, so complex, and all of us are so busy doing all that we can. At this particular point in time, Native people are faced with another decision. It'll probably be not if, when the ANCSA amendments as proposed by AFN are adopted in Congress, and being the political realist that I am at this particular point in time, it looks like those eight resolutions are the resolutions that are going to go forward. Native people are going to be asked to vote on their destiny. They're going to be asked to whether they want to be tribal people or whether they want to be corporate people. And so it seems that we have already achieved some of the objectives of ANCSA as articulated by such people as Guy Martin and others who were involved in the enactment or in Congress, that there was an objective for at least economic assimilation, if we are at the point where we're going to have to vote on it now. And it also seems that we have progressed to a point, I don't know if it's progressed or what, but we are now openly talking about conflicts and differences of opinion in the Native community, because in 1971, we were at least in a unified position of going for a land claim settlement. Now we are talking about corporate Natives versus traditional Natives or tribal people, indigenous people, and tribal governments. Anyway, we are going to be at that point where we have to educate, again, Native people about exactly, you know, what are the effects of the things that you're going to be voting on. If you are going to be voting on accepting new Natives, what are the implications for the survival, of the tribe if you do not vote to amend the law to allow for new Natives? And clearly we already see that we have differences of opinion in the Native community, even though at an emotional level people are saying we want to take care of the new Natives. But when you look at the surveys, and granted that the surveys are not universal, but maybe only taking in 20% of a population, we still see a significant number of people saying, no, we don't want new Natives because it's going to decrease the kinds of money or stock that I have. And so we are at a point now where we have to start educating Native people about what they have to do to survive just with this corporate ANCSA entity, and let alone, you know, talk about, you know, what are the things that we need to define, to identify, to define ourselves as Native people, the kind of things that what Raina was talking about. But now we also have to educate non-Native people about what it is that we want. And I just want to share this with you. I have the responsibility at this particular point in time to be evaluating the proposed curriculum for the State of Alaska Curriculum Guide. And I was supposed to evaluate it for cultural sensitivity, to Native people. I have engaged different Native people around the state to evaluate the different curriculum, the different subjects. And as we had anticipated, the one area of the most difficulty was going to be social science, although I have to say that even in areas as basic as science, computers, and mathematics, we still had problems with cultural sensitivity. But social science turned